It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
I love you, Solo!
Mama Monster.
Conquered! I'm home!
I want your soul.
You like fighting a woman?
You got grown-ass wrestlers in the back going on Twitter.
Come over here and fight me.
Is that Pat Patterson?
You have legs.
Holy mackerel, did he get fat?
I was 99% positive it was just chest up.
No. Congratulations. Who hasn't beat Daniel Garcia?
WrestleMania 42 tickets are on sale for all you high rollers out there. In case you were wondering why they're going back to Vegas next year, these are the prices for people attending both nights. And they don't include Ticketmaster fees, so keep that in mind. Section A1 on the floor will only set you back $9,000. Section B on the floor, nearly $4,000. The 100 level seating ranges from $1,495 down to $1,174. 200 level ranges from $1,300 down to $1,174. 300 level seating, $1,174.80. And 400 level seating, a mere $854.15. But then you got the suites. It's all about the suites. The cheapest one, a corner suite, comes in at a cool $22,000. You can get a club suite, which includes 12 seats and an open bar, for $26,500. There's a more traditional suite that seats 26 people, which goes for $38,000. Or you can spring for the owner's suite package, all-inclusive with 26 tickets, which will set you back a mere $52,500. Hey, you know, if we get our own Sound Off suite at that price and divide it up amongst all 26 of us, that comes out to $2,000 a pop. I'm sure you've got that laying around, right? Who's with me? Of course, that $2,000 doesn't include airfare, hotel, ground transportation, and food. But what the hell? I mean, just tack on another $2,000 or $3,000. What's the big deal? Don't be such a cheap bastard. It's WrestleMania, baby. This is Sound Off, episode 931 for Sunday, September 28th, 2025. I am the Solemn Monster. This show doesn't cost you a thing, but your support is always welcome, and it is very much appreciated. If you want to become a Sound Off VIP, you can always make a PayPal donation of $10 or more to get yourself a nickname and a shout-out here on this very show. I want to say thank you to the Portland pop star all the way across the country, our friend Paul Hamilton. Paul, thank you very much. Big B, Bryant Becerra, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, the Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard, Night Stalker, Nayef Alsafar, Killshot, Keith Hart, and best in the game, Trey Porter. Also want to wish a happy 40th birthday to Chris from Bethlehem, bro. Chris turns the big 4-0 on Monday. And I also want to wish a very happy birthday to Matt. His name is not Matt, but we'll call him Matt to protect his identity, like he's in witness protection. But I've been friends with this guy since high school. What was that, like 50 years ago now? Feels like it. But he is one of my oldest friends. He is my best friend. And I hope that he has himself a great day. The next House of Glory show is coming up quick. With Glory Comes Pride, Friday night, October 10th. The first 5 rows are already sold out. This is the first time I could remember that we have actually had to add a 6th row for a show. 6th row seats are still available for now. Probably not for much longer. And of course, general admission is available. This is going to end up being our biggest show of the year. And we are not done yet. We are hosting a special Super Clash as part of the Big Event Expo coming up in Brentwood, New York, Saturday, November 15th. That's going to be our Long Island debut, with the debut also of Andrade, his first domestic indie appearance since leaving WWE, at least the first one that's been announced. And hey, you know, Bret Hart and Bill Goldberg are both signing at the big event that day. Maybe I could get them both into the ring together at the HOG show. I feel like I'd be brokering peace in the Middle East between these two. Then that Friday, less than a week later, November 21st, we return to Chicago. And we are going to be announcing our plans very soon for our December show, closing out the year. So I hope to see you at all the shows. But you can go to hogwrestling.net to buy tickets to whatever show you wish. coming off a less than stellar ESPN debut last weekend. There was a lot of hoopla this week about Andreas Hale, a combat sports writer for ESPN, who gave the show a C grade, which is an accurate grade, by the way. C, C plus. I might even be generous and go B minus, but it's somewhere in that range. I mean, you get no argument from me. But this is someone who writes for ESPN, WWE's new media rights partner, a partner that shelled out over $1 billion for the rights to air these PLEs for the next 5 years. And people absolutely lost their minds over this. He praised the women's championship match between Stephanie Vaquer and Io Sky, as did I. It was the best thing on the entire show. But he said everything else was either underwhelming or just a setup for a future match. I thought the mixed tag team match was fun for what it was. It wasn't outstanding or anything. It was very long, but it was a fun match. He gave Brock Lesnar against John Cena a C-. Braun Breaker and Bronson Reed against the Usos, he gave a C. The women's world title match, he gave a B+. The mixed tag match with CM Punk and AJ Lee against Seth Rollins and Becky Lynch, he gave that a C. And the Cody Rhodes, Drew McIntyre main event, he gave that a C. He said the women's match saved this show from being truly average, and that for a card that promised to have epic moments, it fell a little short of expectations. Which is what happens when you use a lot of hyperbole to really hype up a show like this and then deliver the show that they did. They have nobody to blame for that but themselves, as far as the way people felt about it. And if they don't like what people are saying about it, they should look in the mirror. There were a lot of fans who agreed with him, but also a lot of fans, the tribalists, who lost their minds over all this. And they couldn't believe that ESPN would post something critical on their main page, right? Since they work together with WWE. Even though before the show, one of the ESPN executives said that its wrestling writers would have full independence in their coverage and there would be a separation of church and state. You had JBL on his Something to Wrestle podcast, which is basically his now since Bruce Pritchard clearly does not want to go back to work and do it anymore. He actually said the writers should have found a way to get creative and give the show an A grade, whether they believed it or not. Because this was their big debut on ESPN and they shouldn't be criticizing the show. Or have someone writing on their behalf criticizing the show. He really said this. He said the quiet part out loud. I almost have to I have to hand it to him. I have to respect him for saying the quiet part out loud. Because you know there are people in that company that share that same opinion. I bet his life on it. He said that when that's the first thing people see on the website for the company paying hundreds of millions of dollars for the product, I just don't think that looks good. Yeah, no shit. Then put out a better product. What he's saying is, lie and pretend that it was a great show, even if you think it wasn't. If ESPN believes what they say, and they said there would be a separation of church and state in its coverage, then this is what their coverage is supposed to look like. They want it to at least come off like their coverage is independent and fair and honest. Whereas JBL is looking at it simply as a business relationship. It's a product. If you want it covered like a real sport, that's not how this works. However much money ESPN might be paying out to Major League Baseball or the NFL for the games that they carry, if there's a major story about either league that paints them in a bad light, right? Some controversy about steroids or concussions or what have you, right? They would have writers covering that story and amplifying that story, no matter how badly the league might come across. That's how it's supposed to work. If you want to be taken seriously. Evidently, JBL doesn't feel that's important. And I'm not saying ESPN would cover WWE that way if there was a big story that painted WWE in a bad light, like the Janelle Grant stuff or some other big lawsuit that gets filed against the company. It's entirely possible they would downplay it and they wouldn't give it the coverage that it deserves. Time will tell how much they really believe in church and state when that happens. But when it comes to these shows, it was a breath of fresh air that they didn't pull the review or they didn't try to hide it when he posted it. It was refreshing to see. It's still only one man's opinion. Just like when Dave Meltzer, he drops his star ratings for a show. It's one man's opinion. And everybody loses their minds over it. But his voice carries more weight than most because he's been covering wrestling for over 40 years. The Observer was the standard for wrestling news for a long time. So if you're in the wrestling bubble, you probably know who Dave Meltzer is. You've at least heard the name before. It's still just one man's opinion. I mean, look, he just posted his star ratings for AEW All Out, okay, in the last newsletter. I thought some of the ratings were completely ridiculous. I mean, once he broke the 5-star scale years ago, the whole thing became laughable to me. Like, he ruined it. Absolutely ruined it. But that's his scale. If he wants to ruin it, that's his prerogative. He can do that. But then I see Dustin Rhodes quote tweeting the ratings and then posting, "That's why we at AEW are the best." You know damn well, if Meltzer would have posted something negative about a Dustin Rhodes match, he'd be the first person tweeting Dave asking if he's ever taken a bump before in his life. You know, talk shit when you lace up a pair of boots, Mark. It's one person's opinion. But when that person writes for ESPN, in the eyes of everyone, it becomes ESPN's opinion, right? They've co-signed it. They've endorsed it. That WrestlePalooza wasn't a great show. Not really, but like, you know what? If that's how people look at it, that it's ESPN's opinion, if that's what gets WWE's attention, then good. I hope it does get their attention. You know, on WrestleVotes Radio, they claim that people within WWE didn't expect ESPN to go out of its way to publish such a low rating for the event, especially since this was their debut on the platform. And backstage, the feeling was that WrestlePalooza was no different than any other PLE, which honestly is part of the fucking problem. But to them, it made it feel like the C grade was unusually critical. And the backstage reaction, they say, highlighted a sense of confusion, as many assumed that ESPN would treat the show more favorably given the significance of the partnership. Instead, the review created a wave of discussion online with fans and critics debating whether the grade was too harsh or an honest assessment of the event. Yes, it was an honest assessment. It's an assessment that I happen to share. Now, we know Paul Levesque doesn't give a shit about what the critics have to say and what shows like this have to say, because he made that very clear earlier this year around WrestleMania time, if you remember that interview where he sat down with Peter Rosenberg and he said, "This is going to sound defensive," because it did. He was sounding very defensive when he said this, but he said, "I wish I could tell people, fuck off being a critic. Be a fan. Go watch this and be a fan." So what he's telling you is that you should not be watching WWE and thinking critically about the show that you're watching. You know, there are fans that aren't a part of the online discourse. Maybe they watch casually. Maybe they watch with their kids, right? That's fine. All different kinds of fans who watch for all different types of reasons. Some longtime fans, some newer fans. But it's the ones that dare say anything critical about the product. It's really something to hear the chief content officer admitting that, you know, what he really wants to do is tell all of those people to fuck off. You know, I enjoy talking about wrestling, as if you couldn't tell. I've been doing it long enough. I enjoy interacting with other fans most of the time on social media and in the YouTube chats. There are things I like. There are things I don't like. And the things that people don't like often get amplified more than the things that they do. That's just the nature of the internet. Like, I'll do a video praising something or praising someone, and it'll get 5,000 views. I do one segment talking about Bret Hart burying people, and it gets 40,000 views. It's like, that's just how it is. Look at cable news. Actually, don't look at cable news. It's fucking horrendous. But if you do look at it, or really just the news in general these days, it's probably 90% negative. You know, 15 people got shot. This person is embroiled in a sex scandal. Hurricane Jerry just wiped out 5 cities and is headed for New York. Russia and Ukraine are still bombing each other. Unemployment was up again this week. Like, I feel like I'm singing a Billy Joel song here. But then in the last 5 minutes of the newscast, we've got a heartwarming story about an 8-year-old boy who runs his own lemonade stand, and the lemons he uses might hold the cure for cancer. This is the world we live in. This is what sells. I try not being overly negative because there's enough negativity in this world. Wrestling should be an escape from all that, but I'm not going to sugarcoat shit. And nobody else should feel compelled to do so either, no matter what outlet they work for. It doesn't mean that you're going to spoon feed me even when it tastes bad, and I'm going to say, "Oh, thank you. May I have another scoop?" He went through his honeymoon phase, Triple H did, and that was only going to last so long. Now that people are being more critical about what they see week to week on these shows, his natural instinct is to tell those people to fuck off. He probably wanted to tell ESPN the same thing this week. But ESPN may be the one party here that he can't tell to go fuck off. He'll just need to do better next time. And if articles like that one, if reviews like that one, help make for a better show next time, then everyone should be cheering that, not bashing the man for his opinion. We got some news from Fightful Select and from BodySlam.net this week pertaining to WrestlePalooza. Per Fightful Select, ESPN wanted a big title match like Cody Rhodes against Drew McIntyre to close the show, which is why it went on last. That should be a huge red flag to anybody listening to this that ESPN is dictating anything related to how the shows are structured. It's one thing to have an independent writer on behalf of ESPN reviewing the show and saying he didn't like this or that, but when the network itself or the company itself is dictating, hey, put this match here and, you know, let's use this person or let's not do this. I'm sorry, that's a huge red flag. They said ESPN wanted the pomp and circumstance surrounding a world title match, and that's the reason why the match went on last, not because Brock Lesnar wanted to fly out early to get home to Saskatchewan. Thank God Lesnar and Cena didn't close the show with that dog shit finish. The mixed tag team match should have closed the show. I said that night. The mixed tag team match should have been the final match on that show. If they had no big finish or angle plan for the title match, the mixed tag should have closed the show. So I can totally believe that the only reason it didn't was because ESPN wanted it that way. Now, per BodySlam.net, both Cody Rhodes and Drew McIntyre pitched a different direction behind the scenes for how their match would go. Their idea would have seen Randy Orton accidentally cost Cody the WWE Championship. That then would have led to Cody chasing again to get the belt back. And upon reclaiming it from McIntyre, Randy Orton would then turn on him after the match. That is a much better idea than what they ended up going with, which was a much more straightforward finish where really McIntyre beat himself. He beat himself. He kicked the desk and hurt his foot. So Cody Rhodes took advantage and he beat him the same way he took advantage of a mistake that Randy Orton made in their King of the Ring match, and he beat him there too. Cody's whole shtick is capitalizing off of other people's mistakes to win matches. Remember when he finished his story last year at WrestleMania? Roman Reigns had a choice. He had the chair in his hand. He could use the chair on Cody or he could use it on Seth Rollins. He opted to hit Rollins with the chair. And in the end, it cost him. That's another example. But that would have been a much better way to go with the finish of that first big ESPN show. Right? You want a big title match in the main event? How about a big title change in the main event? And then at Survivor Series or at the Royal Rumble, Cody wins the belt back. But Randy Orton goes heel on him, and we get Cody defending against Randy Orton at WrestleMania. I mean, Cody's been back in the company almost 4 years now, and I'm still sitting here talking about a possible feud with Randy Orton. So they can still do this. They still have a chance. Book a triple threat match for Survivor Series with Cody, Randy, and Drew, and have Drew win the title there. Don't be afraid to shake things up a bit. There's some good stories that could come out of this. Now, Body Slam also reported that as of late Saturday morning, the day of the show, WWE was planning to have John Cena beat Brock Lesnar at WrestlePalooza. And it's unknown what happened to cause such a sudden and major creative shift. Now, Meltzer, for his part, claims that he was told that that is not the case, and Lesnar was not brought back to lose in his first match. Now, of course, I thought the same thing in 2012 when they brought him back to the company and they beat him in his very first match back against John Cena at Extreme Rules. So, believe what you wish. I always figured Lesnar was winning that match, but I would not have done the match in the first place. They wanted one more John Cena-Brock Lesnar match, or maybe Cena wanted it. But what we got was the worst of all the matches they've ever had. But you would watch that match and figure, well, now we know who John Cena's final opponent is going to be. It's Brock Lesnar. They're going to do the Rocky comeback story with Cena where he slays the beast in his retirement match and he gets a big win and he rides off into the sunset. But Brian Alvarez is reporting that he's been told there will be no rematch with Brock Lesnar and John Cena. That the match we saw at WrestlePalooza was their last match together. Singles match anyway. I mean, there's always a chance they could end up in war games against each other. So now that finish makes even less sense if this is true. Now, I'm not clamoring for another match between Brock Lesnar and John Cena. So if that was really it for them, that's music to my ears. But as dumb as that finish was, it's even dumber now in hindsight if that turns out to be true. Let's just kill John Cena, and we'll waste the match on this retirement tour to make Brock Lesnar look strong. As if this was needed to make Brock Lesnar look strong. They've been making Brock Lesnar look strong for fucking 11 years, 12 years, 13 years. What's it been? 2012 he came back. 13 fucking years they've been making Brock Lesnar look strong. Yeah, let's make Brock look strong by beating the 48-year-old who's retiring because his body can't take it anymore. That'll make him look super strong. So there's talk of Bron Breakker as a potential opponent for Lesnar next year, maybe even as soon as WrestleMania. The move for WrestleMania would probably be Brock Lesnar and Gunther, because that's the match they were going to do 2 years ago, so we know it's on their mind. Either that or Lesnar and Breakker. Now, if you gave me the choice of picking one, I'm going Brock Lesnar and Bron Breakker. That match intrigues me way more. And it's a match that would benefit Breakker in a way that it wouldn't benefit Gunther, who's not beating Brock. Okay? I mean, 2 years ago, I would have said yes. Especially when the Intercontinental title might have been on the line, Brock should not be beating Gunther. Now I think if they did the match, Gunther's going to lose. Breakker losing in a competitive match with Brock Lesnar, it wouldn't damage him much. But Breakker beating Brock Lesnar, that would mean far more to his career than losing in a competitive match would. Now, after being slaughtered at WrestlePalooza, John Cena's opponent for Crown Jewel next month has been revealed, and it is someone who I was hoping to see him back in the ring with one last time on this tour. 30 minutes before Raw went on the air Monday night, John Cena did something that he has not done a single time this entire retirement tour. Or really any other time in his career that I can remember. And he more or less lobbied for a match on social media. He simply posted the hashtag Cena versus Styles thoughts. That's called planting the seed. And you don't do that unless you either want the match or you already know it's happening and you're giving people the match. And he followed that up with, I do not choose my opponents, but I, even through tough times, always listen to the fans. At AJStylesORG, are you listening? Better yet, at Triple H, are you listening? And AJ Styles was quick to respond. He says, I hear them loud and clear. Let's do it. I'm ready. So, of course, Triple H chimed in like the knight in shining armor. And he tweeted, John Cena versus AJ Styles is a match we all want to see. And at Crown Jewel, we will. So it's official. John Cena versus AJ Styles, one last time in Perth, Australia. What a coincidence they announced this right after so many people shit on what happened to WrestlePalooza. Dave Meltzer says Cena versus Styles was always the plan for Australia, going back to at least the week where Styles cut that weird work shoot promo during one of the commercials on Raw. That hasn't gone anywhere since then, now that I think about it. If it was the plan, it's adorable how they had Cena tweet about it first to make it seem like the fans helped make it happen. But it makes Triple H look like, again, the man of the people all of a sudden, right? He's giving the people what they want. Well played. Well played. Cena posted a photo on his Instagram of that guy from the movie Captain Phillips with Tom Hanks. I think, what was it, the pirates that take over the ship. It's the guy who says, I'm the captain now. He posted that image, no context. Yeah, you're the captain now. Because again, you know, the implication being that he's taken the reins now of his own retirement tour. He's the captain now. Yeah, you're the captain now. When you have three fucking matches left on your tour, now you're the captain. Where was the captain 6 months ago when we needed you? Mr. I don't lobby for matches. I'm just glad we're getting the match because I had given up hope of it happening with so few appearances left. You know, as it is, he's not scheduled for any television until Crown Jewel. So this is literally just throwing, you know, a match out there, a dream match, if you want to call it that, even though we've seen it before. It's throwing a match out there that they know the live crowd is going to eat up. Styles has given Cena some of the best matches of his entire career. Their SummerSlam match from 2016 is my favorite of the bunch. I had the pleasure of being in the building for that one. That was special. Their last match was excellent. Actually, it wasn't their last match. They had a TV match. But their last big pay-per-view match was excellent. That was the Royal Rumble match in 2017, where they never left the ring one single time during the entire match. Nobody got thrown into the ring steps. There was no big bump on the announce desk. They kept everything in the ring. And Cena tied Ric Flair with 16 world titles. That was John Cena's last truly great match of his career, up until the match he had with Cody Rhodes at SummerSlam this year. It had been 8 years since he had a match that great. Now they get to run it back one last time. See, this is the kind of thing I was hoping for to see out of this tour. Now, AJ Styles, he may not be getting a tour of his own, but if we take him at his word, his career is coming to an end also, very soon. A lot sooner than people may have expected. In speaking with Tokyo Sports this week to promote WWE's upcoming tour dates in Japan next month, he said that these shows coming up may be the final times he gets to perform in Japan. He said, "I will probably appear at WrestleMania, but it's not confirmed yet. The details are still undecided, but I will definitely retire within the next year. I don't want to show my fans a side of me that isn't AJ Styles. That's the main reason. I've decided to retire before my body can no longer move." And regarding his plans after retirement, he said, "I haven't decided yet, but I think I'll probably work for WWE. It might be good to train young wrestlers to be worthy of being on the main roster, but I don't know yet." 6 months ago, he sat down with Chris Van Vliet, and he told Chris that he will not wrestle at 50. "I promise you that," he said. "I will not be wrestling at 50. Although he didn't say anything about 51. "Take that year off, AJ. You deserve it. Then come back for that second run." No, he's been saying that for a while, that he's done at the age of 50. He's 48 right now. He'll be 49 in June. So, I mean, technically, he could still live up to that, but he could still get through the entire year next year. I don't know if that's something he wants to do, but man, it's like, I hear him talking about that. John Cena, Hiroshi Tanahashi, now AJ Styles. It really feels like the end of an era playing out right before our eyes. But Fightful reported some time ago that AJ's contract is up around February of next year. So that's probably why he said it's not confirmed yet that he'll be at WrestleMania. I'm sure they could extend him out to WrestleMania if his deal is up before then. I cannot imagine that they allow AJ Styles to retire in February or March when they're that close to WrestleMania. If we're going to get a John Cena retirement match in December and not at WrestleMania, then why not give AJ Styles one at WrestleMania next year? I don't need an AJ Styles retirement tour. Not after the way these people book John Cena's retirement tour. No, thank you. But his last match being at WrestleMania, that would be a worthy send-off for this guy. A guy that has been one of the elite performers of his generation. He really has been. The body of work that he put together in TNA, the work that he did during that short run in New Japan, winning the IWGP title and leading Bullet Club, and then in WWE, he was pushed harder right out of the gate than I ever thought he would be. But in his first year, he had that great Rumble debut, back-to-back title matches with Roman Reigns on pay-per-view, then a program that saw him beat John Cena twice in 2 months. First Money in the Bank, and then at SummerSlam. And then a month after that, he won the WWE Championship. That's not a bad first year. I wish I could say the same for all of his other years there. You know, the last few have not been kind to AJ Styles between the injuries and the booking. The man deserves a major send-off. He may not have been a WWE guy the way John Cena was a WWE guy. John Cena was a product of WWE. You know, AJ Styles made his name outside of WWE. But next year is going to be his 10-year anniversary in this company. 10 years of AJ Styles in WWE. It just sells itself. Now watch them run back Styles and Jericho again in AJ's last match. That was his first WrestleMania match. It was against Chris Jericho. They may give it to us again next year. So after Crown Jewel, Cena's got 4 appearances left by my count. Boston on November 10th, Madison Square Garden on November 17th, Survivor Series in San Diego on November 29th, and Washington, D.C. for his final match on Saturday night's main event on December 13th. And I could see it shaping up like this. You've got that Boston show, right, on November 10th. There's been some chatter about Dominic Mysterio being considered as an opponent at some point on this tour for John Cena. You do John Cena challenging Dominic Mysterio for the Intercontinental title in Boston. Since people seem to want so badly for him to challenge, I get so many fucking questions about John Cena. Should he challenge for the Intercontinental title? He could win the Grand Slam. Right? There's enough people out there who clearly want to see it. He's not going to win it. You know, he's not winning the Intercontinental title. But you do that match on that show in Boston. Then at MSG, we get John Cena against Seth Rollins. Not for the World Heavyweight title, but if they end up leading their own respective teams in War Games, or even if Cena's not the captain, let's say he's in War Games, he's on someone else's team. If they're on opposite ends of that War Games match, you could do Cena against Rollins one last time at MSG for the man advantage. And then in his final match in December, we get John Cena against Gunther. Like in Dom, he gets to work with a younger talent who could get the rub from it. Against Seth, he's in there with another old rival. And there's something tangible on the line as far as War Games goes. And then with Gunther, it's a newer name. He's never wrestled before. But it's somewhat a little more well-established than, you know, someone like Dominic would be. So that way you get some variation with all three opponents. Now, watching Obafemi lose the NXT Championship last night at No Mercy, the thought did cross my mind of putting Oba in there and letting him be the one to retire John Cena and really launching him. But the Brock Lesnar match just killed it last weekend. Because the only way that works, like in my mind, as dominant as a champion as Obafemi has been, and the man is just, he's a physical specimen. You look at him and he looks like a gladiator, this guy. The only way that works is if Oba goes in there and just decimates John Cena. Like, it can't be an overly competitive match. I'm sorry. I don't care how much more experience John Cena has. You can't do that. Like, to me, that just doesn't work. But you've already done the Cena decimation against Brock. And frankly, nobody wants to see that in John Cena's last match. Nobody is going to want to see John Cena go in there in his last match and get absolutely slaughtered by somebody in 4 minutes. I mean, I would build that entire Saturday night's main event show around the Cena match. So you need to be able to deliver one last really great match that has some length to it. You know, whoever wins, it's got to be a competitive match. I just don't see that with Obafemi. Oba is not the right guy for that spot. John Cena's dad, by the way, should mention this, was no fan of his son's match with Brock Lesnar. He called it a squash match. He said the images of crying children is not how you want business to go. This is what he told Chris Featherstone on the Unscripted podcast on Sports Kita. He also said the start of his son's heel turn was great, but the storyline was destroyed when The Rock and Travis Scott were no longer involved. He said that wasn't something he was too hyped up on. I agree with Mr. Cena, the true wise man. Today's episode is sponsored by Mint Mobile. I don't usually like hearing the word no. I didn't like it when I was a kid and my parents would tell me no. I didn't like it when I asked that one girl out in college and she said no. No can be a dirty word, but not if you're still overpaying for wireless. That's when it's time to say yes to saying no. At Mint Mobile, their favorite word is no, as in no contracts, no monthly bills, no overages, no hidden fees, no BS. That's why I said yes to making the switch and getting premium wireless for just $15 a month. You're probably overspending right now for overpriced wireless with their ridiculous monthly bills, unexpected overages, and hidden fees. With Mint, plans start at $15 a month. All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text, all delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. Use your own phone and your own phone number with any Mint Mobile plan and bring along all of your existing contacts, too. Since I started using Mint, I've had no complaints about their service. It's been fast. It's been reliable. No drop calls or, hey, you sound like you're underwater. Right? I've had that before with other carriers. Plus, when I get my bill each month now compared to what it used to be, it is staggering to think how much money I was throwing away for inferior service when I could have been with Mint all along. I'm glad I gave Mint a shot, and you will be too. You'll be very happy, especially with this special offer for Sound Off listeners. Ready to say yes to saying no? Make the switch at mintmobile.com/solomonster. That's mintmobile.com patreon.com/solamonster. Upfront payment of $45 required, equivalent to $15 a month. Limited time new customer offer for first 3 months only. Speeds may slow above 35 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Taxes and fees extra. See Mint Mobile for details. The rest of the Crown Jewel card is shaping up like this. We have the two Crown Jewel title matches, Cody Rhodes against Seth Rollins and Stephanie Vaquer against Tiffany Stratton, who retained her WWE Women's Championship on SmackDown Friday night in a main event that just completely fell apart there at the very end. Whatever could go wrong did go wrong. It started with Nia Jax throwing Jade Cargill into the ring steps outside hard, and Jade suffered a nasty gash on her left eyebrow. If you saw the photos on her Instagram, it is disgusting. They actually slapped a content warning on it. That's how bad it was. And it honestly reminded me of the gash I got on my leg, on my knee. I mean, mine was bigger, but it's kind of got that same shape to it. It looks like a slot machine. It looks like a slot that you would shove a quarter into to play a new game. That's what it looks like. There's blame to go around on this one. Nia should have put a little more distance between her and the steps when she threw Jade into them. There really wasn't much room there. But Jade should have gotten her hands up, so I don't think you could just put that on one person and not the other. But then, after they got back in the ring, Jade dropped her with the Eye of the Storm, and she had her pinned. Tiffany was supposed to break up the fall, clearly, but she was going to be late. You could see the panic on Nia's face, so Nia kicked out. Then Tiffany comes flying in, nails Jade with a dropkick, and Jade rolls out of the ring, and Tiffany went to go steal the pin, which was clearly going to be the finish of the match. But Nia had already kicked out, right? Because Tiffany was going to be late on the previous spot. So Tiffany just covering her and pinning her really wouldn't have made much sense anyway. The finish was already ruined. But she covered Nia anyway, and referee Daphne LeSean, she counts one, she counts two, and then she held up at three, even though Nia did not kick out. And the crowd went silent. Like, it looked awful. I thought the match was a mess, honestly, even before all of this happened. But at that point, it just fell off a fucking cliff. And Tiffany went up. She hit her prettiest moonsault ever. And she pinned Nia to retain the title. She was going to win the match anyway, so it didn't affect the actual finish of the match. And it's going to be Tiffany against Stephanie at Crown Jewel. They were really pushing that Tiffany, you know, coming into this triple threat, they were really pushing that Tiffany is undefeated this year. I think that needs to end at Crown Jewel. Stephanie should not be losing to Tiffany Stratton. And Seth is not losing to Cody Rhodes again, not after Cody won the Crown Jewel belt last year. He also won at WrestlePalooza. Seth did not. And if the Vision is headed for War Games, then Rollins needs this win a lot more than Cody does. So we have those two matches, plus Cena against AJ Styles. And it sure feels like we're going to get a tag team match with Rhea Ripley and Io Sky against Asuka and Kairi Sane. We actually got a great main event on Monday night with Rhea and Asuka. As much as I disliked the main event on Friday, I love the main event on Monday. And it finally happened. We got the Asuka heel turn. She's been trending that way for weeks, but they made it official. And when the match was over, she misted Rhea in the face, turned her into a smurf. Io came out to try to calm things down. Asuka gave her a hug and then turned on Io and then forced Kairi to do the same. Io is going to be wrestling Mayu Iwatani on the Marigold show, October 26th. Marigold posted a video on Friday of Io challenging Mayu to a match at their Dream Destiny show. They were tag team partners in Stardom many years ago, twice holding the Trios titles together and once holding the tag team titles. This will be their first singles match since Stardom's Cinderella tournament in 2018. And this is going to end up on a lot of people's match of the year lists, I can guarantee it. WWE is running back-to-back shows in Tokyo on its Japanese tour the week before, so I guess Io will just stay over the extra week and then work the match with Mayu and then fly back. But WWE has announced some of the initial matches for those shows. Friday, October 17th, get this, Julia defends the Women's United States Championship in a three-way against Io Sky and Rhea Ripley. Now that's a fucking match. Put that on my TV. Seth Rollins defends the World Heavyweight title against CM Punk. I am just so over the Punk and Seth stuff. It's just not even funny. Shinsuke Nakamura. They're in Japan, so they're going to dust them off. How's this for a random pairing? It'll be Nakamura and Jey Uso teaming up to take on Bron Breakker and Bronson Reed. Then on Saturday, October 18th, Julia defends her U.S. title, assuming she's still the champion, of course, and doesn't lose it the night before. She defends the U.S. title against Kairi Sane, with Asuka in her corner. Rhea Ripley and Io Sky take on Raquel Rodriguez and Roxanne Perez. And CM Punk, Jey Uso, and Shinsuke Nakamura take on Seth Rollins, Bron Breakker, and Bronson Reed. The annual PWI 500 rankings dropped this week. I usually cover this each year. This is a list based solely on kayfabe, although that doesn't stop people from passionately debating it. The evaluation period for this was August 1st, 2024, through July 31st of this year. And it weighs the following criteria. And this is important to keep in mind. This is what they go by. Your win-loss record, championships won, quality of competition, major feuds, prominence within a wrestler's promotion, and overall wrestling ability. So all of those things are factored in here to these rankings, and topping the list at number one for the second straight year, becoming only the fourth wrestler ever to do so after Bret Hart, 1993 and 94, Steve Austin, 1998 and 99, and John Cena, 2006 and 2007. Coming in at number one this year is the American Nightmare, Cody Rhodes, winning for 2024 and now 2025. So last year, let's see here, last year would have included him leading his team to victory in War Games, winning his second straight Royal Rumble, feuding with The Rock, headlining both nights of WrestleMania, and finishing his story to win the WWE Championship, and really becoming the face of the company, becoming the face of WWE, right? You can't really argue against that. So that was last year, though. For this period, it would include his crown jewel win over Gunther, his entire feud with Kevin Owens, including their ladder match at the Royal Rumble, his WrestleMania loss to John Cena, and his King of the Ring win over Randy Orton. So still a strong year, but not as strong as last year. He took more of a backseat this year to Cena, since it's Cena's retirement year. Number two is Jon Moxley, up from number eight the year before. That's largely based on him holding the AEW World Championship for nearly that entire period, and he was leading the Death Riders, wrestling in multiple pay-per-view main events. I mean, when you consider the criteria that they're using here, I can't argue with this pick. Number three is Gunther, who spent a good portion of that period as the World Heavyweight Champion, and he also retired Bill Goldberg. Hail Hydra, I mean Gunther. Still waiting for Goldberg to tell his side of the story that he teased on Ariel Helwani's show. He said, wait a couple of weeks. That was a couple of months ago. Sounds like someone was gotten to. Number four, Hangman Adam Page. Number five is Hirooki Goto, who had a nice, unexpected run as the IWGP World Champion, and is also one of the wrestlers that is filming for the new Street Fighter movie. I believe he is going to be E. Honda. Number six is Jey Uso, cracking the top 10 for the first time in his career. Number seven is Swerve Strickland, who falls from number two last year to number seven this year. Number eight is Seth Rollins, down from number four last year, and he was actually number one the year before that. Number nine is Mystico, who is legitimately one of the biggest names in the history of the business. I mean, that's the kind of success that he has had in Mexico and continues to have. And number 10 is Will Ospreay, down from number three last year. Jey Uso over Will Ospreay, I get it based on the criteria, but man, it hurts my soul. Now, rounding out the top 25, I'm not going to read the whole list, but we'll go through the top 25. Number 11, Kazuchika Okada. Number 12, Joe Hendry. Number 13, Zack Sabre Jr. Number 14, Oba Femi. Number 15, CM Punk. Wow. Oba over Punk. Oba was very important to the NXT brand, though. You know, your prominence and significance to your company and your brand is a big part of the criteria here. So I kind of get it. But yes, number 15 is CM Punk. Number 16 is Bandido. Number 17, Konosuke Takeshita. Number 18, Damian Priest. Number 19, Trick Williams. Number 20, Jacob Fatu. Number 21, Nick Nemeth. Number 22, LA Knight.
Yeah.
Number 23, Mascara Dorada. Number 24, Braun Breaker. And number 25, Masha Slamovich. And oh, the firestorm that set off this week. I'm going to get to that in a bit. Her appearing at number 25 on this list, that was the catalyst for all the shit that came out this week. So people who say the PWI 500 doesn't matter, you can't say that this year. It's also weird that she was on there at all because they have a separate list for the women that comes out later this year, but Masha's on here. Megan Bain is on here. Billy Starks was on here. The only thing I could think of is that if they wrestled any intergender matches, that would make them eligible to be on the main list. Because otherwise, I mean, to not have people on here like Toni Storm and Rhea Ripley is ridiculous. My top five, I don't even know what my criteria is. It's called my gut. My top five would be in no particular order. Cody Rhodes, Seth Rollins, Hangman Page, Will Ospreay, and Gunther. That would be my top five. But since I mentioned Masha Slamovich, this is as good a place as any to talk about this, because she was involved in a major controversy this week. The former TNA Knockouts champion had allegations of domestic abuse levied against her. She was scheduled to challenge Ash by Elegance, the former Dana Brooke, for the title on Friday at the TNA Victory Road pay-per-view, but was pulled from the show. As she was several independent dates that she was scheduled for, I'm not sure if those promotions pulled her or if she pulled herself. TNA definitely pulled her. And that made news in and of itself. Ash by Elegance came out on the show on Friday and vacated the championships, saying that she is no longer able to compete and she would be stepping away from in-ring competition. And it definitely did not come off as a happy announcement for anyone thinking Naomi. Maybe it's a similar type of deal. It didn't come off that way. Hopefully it's nothing too serious, but it was serious enough that she gave a speech and she vacated the title. So instead, they held a battle royal with the final two women, Kalani Jordan of NXT and Li Ying Li, the former Xia Li, moving on to a singles match later in the show to crown a new champion, which ended up being Kalani Jordan. Another TNA title claimed by a WWE talent. But I heard it was a really good match. I did see the spot circulating online, the botch, where Jordan came off the apron with what looked to be a Rana that maybe she was going for on the floor, and Lee just dropped her hard with what ended up being a powerbomb. And then she just popped right back up and no-sold it, because that wasn't the planned spot. This is how they're teaching these wrestlers. It's like they're not capable of thinking on the fly, which is a terrible quality not to have. Like, if something like that happens, especially as devastating as this looked, fucking sell it. Don't pop right back up like nothing happened just because it wasn't supposed to happen. It happened. Like, even if you just sell it briefly and then pick up with whatever you were supposed to do, fucking sell it. But anyway, Masha wasn't there. And it started on Tuesday with her ranking number 25 on the PWI 500 list. After which came a flood of allegations and photos and text messages on social media after a friend of her ex-boyfriend, who's also a wrestler named Akira. He has performed for MLW and GCW and CMLL, among other promotions. His friend called out Slamovich for allegedly abusing Akira physically and mentally over the course of their relationship. And those allegations included a link to a Dropbox with over 100 screenshots of texts, alleged texts, between the two. They haven't been authenticated, but there's no reason to believe that they're fake. That feature Slamovich admitting in these messages to hitting Akira, alleging demands for money, and what could really just be described as emotional abuse. And the social media posts also featured photos of cuts and bruises on Akira's face and wrists. The texts range from 2022 to earlier this year. As a result of this, Masha is now under internal investigation by TNA. The promotion told Sports Illustrated on Tuesday, "We take any allegations like this very seriously and have begun an internal investigation." WWE sources also told Fightful Select that any plans of using her for their TNA invasion angle would be paused if there were any plans. Fightful Select also learned that Masha's contract with TNA is up relatively soon, and it was still up in the air whether or not she would even remain with the company. She was scheduled to lose her TNA Knockouts title match against Ash by Elegance, which of course ended up not even happening. So none of this is a good sign for her future in TNA, or even possibly WWE. Now, Akira posted a statement of his own on social media on Tuesday, admitting that, among other things, admitting that he tried to commit suicide on three separate occasions. He said, "I woke up to this and people asking me if I was okay. Kind of want to throw up, kind of want to go away forever. My friend held back for months because I asked her to, and I would have never said anything. I still really don't want to. I didn't want to lash out in anger because I was angry, suicidal, and depressive since the end of January. I'm not alive, though, if she didn't take my calls every day while caring for her sick grandfather. I'm not alive if my roommate didn't laugh with me at stupid videos daily. I'm not alive if Dale Patricks and Simon Gotch weren't there for me. I gave a lot with little in return. I had a lot of growing up to do, and despite my progression, I was always told I was never doing enough. The things I liked and did were stupid and wastes of time. Things I told about my thoughts on my gender and the confusion I was feeling was turned on me. I was lied to about finances and spent more than I should have because I thought we were struggling together. I almost killed myself three times as the life I tried to build with someone was torn apart and I became nothing to that person. It was like a withdrawal. Every time I went to the hospital, that person I put on a pedestal was gone. I didn't matter. I would have never said anything. I only came out with my prior experiences of sexual abuse because I was spiraling alone in Japan. I tried my best, but my best was never good enough, and all my accomplishments and money were nothing but tools for someone else. Many things said in confidence turned and used against me. I can't get that time back. I can't get the money back. I can't get the last 4 years of my life back. I was just trying my best to come back and be with my family and friends and dog and try to get signed. I dreamed of doing things. Maybe it won't happen now. I'm not angry. I'm not sad. Not anymore. I'm apathetic. I've moved on and there's still bitterness in my stomach. I don't let it guide me. I've grown up as a person and a wrestler. I've grown up mentally, physically, and spiritually. I'm still fighting, or figuring, things out and have nothing to say to that person. I adored them. I still feel phantom pains in my heart every time I see a photo. They're a part of my life and history. I don't get to where I am now, a mature and thoughtful person with a healthy dose of CTE without the experiences I went through and the isolation I experienced in a foreign country. But it is what it is. Whatever happens, happens. And he followed that up 2 days later with a message where, again, he appreciates everyone coming to his defense. He wishes no ill will on this other person, obviously referring to Masha. He talks about forgiveness. It's a long message, but it's a more sort of positive, uplifting message, a more optimistic message about one of forgiveness and growth. Masha finally responded to all of this with a message on social media on Wednesday night. She said, "Up until the beginning of this year, I was in a toxic and mutually destructive relationship. We hurt each other deeply and in private moments failed to treat each other with the consideration and respect that we both deserve. I take responsibility for my actions and I am sorry, embarrassed, and ashamed of the role I played in our relationship and the way things turned out. In the time since, I have sought help to reflect on this time and deal with conflict in more mature, healthier, and sustainable ways. I apologize to those that I let down, including my former partner. I hope he is able to heal. This will be my only statement on the matter." So she did apologize and claim to take responsibility for her actions. She didn't deny any of the photos or screenshots that were posted were anything but genuine. But it is interesting how she goes out of her way in that opening sentence to make it known that it was a mutually destructive relationship. That's certainly a choice. It's one that really angered their former roommate who posted this, and then we'll move on. "I'm awake, thought about a response, typed one out last night, deleted it. I realized the only thing I truly need to say is that it wasn't mutual. And if I wanted to, I would post what videos I have of their fights that would go hours on end, waking me up anytime from midnight to 3 a.m., where it would be hours on hours of her screaming at him, repeating herself over and over. The time she would physically assault him to immediately asking why he wouldn't just put his hands up or try and stop her. I had talk after talk after talk with both of them that they needed to break up with each other. And for as much as Akira would simply respond that he loved her and thought that they could work through it together, she was on the opposite spectrum, believing her actions were justified and actually needed to help turn Akira into whatever image suited her fancy that month. If it wasn't his gear, it was his body shape. If it wasn't his body shape, it was his moveset. If it wasn't the moves, it was the companies he worked for. If it wasn't the companies he worked for, then it was the matches that he was taking on. If I ever spoke up about anything, I was threatened physically, told that I would be put in the hospital or fucking killed. My first year there is actually, I actually told them I needed to leave and go home to take care of my mom. Her health started deteriorating worse in 2023, and I tried to bring this up. Akira wanted me to stay because that's my best friend and brother, and we made a promise to each other. Masha's only reason for wanting me to stay was because she didn't want to have to pay more for rent. And who was going to take care of the dog and cook for us? And then would also guilt trip me about staying, reminding me how she had helped me out with rent months prior. She cares only about herself. And the longer I stayed there, the more I realized it. But because I thought I was with people who wanted to help me achieve my dreams, I looked the other way and let a lot of shit slide. But nothing about that situation was mutual. I have no real regrets over my place in that situation. I probably prevented more shit from happening than whatever did. If anything, I'll regret losing friends for saying anything because I'm sure it will happen. So this is just one giant mess, is what this is. And there's enough there to where I think it'll be a while before we see Masha back out there wrestling again. Her best move right now would be to lay low and do some soul searching because it wasn't even her ex who came out with this. It was other people that she angered enough to where they just couldn't hold it in any longer. You know, they could not hold their tongues any longer. And it just goes to show you, you know, domestic abuse, it goes both ways. Because I saw a lot of comments this week about, oh, this is different than what you usually hear about. And this is unusual. You know, you just assume the victim is the female, right? That's what a lot of people do. When you hear a domestic abuse story on the news with a celebrity or an athlete or someone of note, or really any situation, honestly, but it absolutely goes both ways. And I'm sure there's still a stigma attached to that with a lot of men who choose not to out themselves, right, as a victim, because they think that it will somehow make them less masculine. Like, I'm not saying that's the case here, but especially in a business like the wrestling business, or really in sports in general, you don't think that that isn't a problem with guys being afraid to speak up for fear of how they'll be perceived? I'm sure it happens way more than we'll ever know. But abuse, physical or otherwise, is not gender specific. It is very much gender neutral. And no matter who you are, it's not right. Nobody should have to live like that or feel like they're trapped in a toxic relationship. And if Masha is the monster that these people make her out to be, I can only hope that she learns from this and becomes a better person, because she looks absolutely awful in this entire situation. We did get a TNA invasion on NXT this week. Lots of TNA stars in the house, many of which were watching from the crowd during the title for title main event between Trick Williams and Obafemi for both the NXT and TNA World Championships. Mike Santana joined on commentary. He's wrestling Trick for the TNA title of Bound for Glory. The match broke down after Trick slapped Santana and Santana struck him back, which, if you think about it, really should have been a disqualification since Trick got hit and not Oba. Trick should be the NXT champion right now. But all the TNA names got into the ring and started fighting with the NXT roster. Matt Cardona was there, Steve Macklin, Frankie Kazarian, Cedric Alexander, and others. Then last night on the NXT No Mercy show, General Manager Ava announced an NXT versus TNA invasion show. They even brought back the old Invasion pay-per-view logo from 2001. It will be a special episode of NXT on the CW network on Tuesday, October 7th, which just so happens to be the same night that AEW is doing its Title Tuesday episode of Dynamite. They're doing Dynamite on Tuesday and Collision on Wednesday that week from Daly's place in Jacksonville. And so NXT's answer to this is to do an invasion show on free TV that will feature two Survivor Series-style elimination matches, one for the men and one for the women, with NXT talent wrestling TNA talent. The members of each team will be announced this Tuesday, I guess by their respective authority figures. Ava will be there and Santino Marella will be there. Plus, Dark State will meet the Hardys in a battle between the NXT Tag Team Champions and the TNA Tag Team Champions, title for title. We got the Hardys coming into House of Glory 3 days later to challenge for the HOG tag team titles. They may well be walking into the NYC arena that Friday as the NXT and TNA tag team champions. How wild is that? They should win the NXT titles. It's about time somebody from the TNA side took some titles from the WWE side instead of the other way around. And I don't think WWE would mind much because they probably look at the Hardys as WWE guys anyway. Ridge Holland will not be there. I saw he was injured at the TNA tapings in Edmonton last night in a match against Moose. Looked like he hurt his foot or his ankle. Couldn't put any weight on it at all. Moose even helped him to the back, so that is not a good sign. But I watched the rest of the No Mercy card. I thought it was a good show. Javon Evans had himself a great 24 hours. He wrestled Sami Zayn in the U.S. title open challenge on SmackDown in what was an awesome match. And then beating Josh Briggs. Now, he didn't win on Friday, but he won last night, beat Josh Briggs in a good match. Not nearly as great as the match on Friday, but still, it was a good showing. His stock has definitely been elevated this weekend. Jordan Grace beat Blake Monroe in a weaponized steel cage match. I thought that this was adequate. That's a word I should probably start using more often when I review these shows. Adequate. These two were better than the pink weapons and the hairdryer and the diamonds and all the bullshit. Jordan won, Blake lost. Get them both up on SmackDown, please, as soon as possible. Like, I know Shawn Michaels doesn't want to give these people up, but SmackDown needs them a lot more than NXT does. At least one of them. Okay, I'm willing to compromise here. At least one of them. But the women's division needs them. Ethan Page retained his North American title over Tavion Heights, who has star potential. I didn't expect him to win here, but I thought he looked good. JC Jane keeps the NXT Women's Championship over Lola Vice. Lola is someone who is tabbed to be a star on the main roster. I don't feel the same about JC's chances. I think Shawn Michaels likes her, and she's gotten better. But when I see Lola, I see a star. When I see JC, I don't. When it comes to the main roster, I'm sorry. And then in the main event, Ricky Saints ends the dominant reign of Oba Femi to win the NXT championship. I wasn't too surprised by the outcome here just because what's left for Oba to do on this show, right? I mean, they either had to pull the trigger on Ricky here or call him up to the main roster. And instead, it looks like Oba may be headed up soon, and he should be. You know, if he isn't in the same conversation with guys like Bron Breakker and Jacob Fatu, then he should be. Because a lot of people talk about Breakker, and even on TV now, they're talking about, you know, Paul Heyman comes out with the same shtick every fucking week, you know, and this guy's going to headline WrestleMania for 5 years in a row, and which will be great, by the way, because that's a surefire way to get people to turn against him. But yeah, this guy's going to main event WrestleMania, and people say the same thing about Jacob Fatu. I've been saying it, but I definitely think Oba needs to be in that conversation. Because he has all the tools to be one of the men carrying this company for years to come. I've said it before, call him up and give him the Gunther push. Start him out with one of the mid-card titles and let him run undefeated for at least a year. You've got Sami Zayn doing the open challenge gimmick right now on SmackDown for the United States Championship. As much as I'm going to hate it when it's over because it's the best thing on Friday nights right now, and I'm not saying do it this week, but debut him in the open challenge and have him kill Sammy to win the U.S. title. Have him show up 1 week and just wreck shop. That's how you make a new star. And finally, TNA announced this week that Mickie James and the Beautiful People, Velvet Sky and Angelina Love, will be inducted into the TNA Hall of Fame, class of 2025, next month at Bound for Glory. Mickie is a no-brainer. I mean, a five-time Knockouts champion. Velvet and Angelina, they also had runs as Knockouts champion. Gail Kim was inducted in 2016. Awesome Kong was inducted in 2021. As that division goes, those two were a must to go in first, right? They put the knockouts on the map. And then it was Tracy Brooks in 2023. Now Mickey and the beautiful people are going in, so they're showing a lot of love for the women. And we'll see if that's it. That's three. They've never inducted more than three people in one class before. Now on the AEW front, speaking of Gail Kim, I was going to talk about this because that was the other big, the Masha thing I talked about, but the other big controversy exploded on social media had to do with Gail Kim responding to somebody on Twitter and then giving her opinions on Riho based on a clip that she saw from many years ago, and people did not like Gail's opinion about Riho. And I didn't think that what Gail said, honestly, with that initial opinion, was any big deal. I really didn't see what the big deal was. People talk about Riho being bullied. She wasn't bullying Riho, okay? These people need to stop. She wasn't bullying Riho with that first comment she made. Riho's not even on social media anymore, at least not Twitter, because she was bullied off the platform a few years ago, and people said some very unkind, unnecessary, disgusting things about her. But to equate these comments that Gail made, and it's like, are you not allowed to have an opinion about somebody? Apparently, just having an opinion now is bullying. So I was going to get into the specifics of what was said and everything, but then Gail has been tweeting the entire weekend. This has been going on for days now. She has been replying to everybody who will tweet her. She has been quote tweeting and replying, and I just stopped tracking this shit after a while because it just got to the point where it's like, I don't know what the fuck she's doing. I really don't. Now she's getting into it with every single person and troll and everybody who has something to say, and she's just going back and forth, and it's exhausting. And I just said, you know what? Fuck this. I'm not even gonna talk about this. I'm not even gonna get into the nuts and bolts of this. How does she have time in her day to respond in the way that she has been responding to all of these people? Is this all she does? There's responding to a few people, and then there's whatever the hell this has been. So you know what? Fuck it. I have nothing else to say about this situation. Whatever she says from here on out, let her answer for it. I have nothing else to contribute to this. Today's episode is sponsored by Hims. No one plans for hair loss. You might think about it from time to time and get all freaked out about it. Then you say to yourself, I'm not there yet. I've still got time. But time has a funny way of creeping up on you. And one day you look in the mirror and you realize, oh no, time's up. You don't have to be freaked out anymore. I've got good news for you. Through Hims, you can take steps to get your hair back and do so with confidence. And access treatments made with clinically proven ingredients like finasteride and minoxidil to stop hair loss in its tracks and regrow hair in 3 to 6 months. No waiting rooms, no hoops to jump through, just ingredients with a track record of results. Hims offers convenient access to a range of prescription hair loss treatments with ingredients that work, including chews, oral medications, serums, and sprays. Doctor-trusted, clinically proven ingredients like finasteride and minoxidil can stop hair loss and regrow hair in as little as 3 to 6 months. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hims brings expert care straight to you with 100% online access to personalized treatments that put your goals first. No hidden fees, no surprise costs, just real personalized care on your schedule. Think of Hims as your digital front door that gets you back to your old self with simple 100% online access to trusted treatments for real health concerns all in one place. For simple online access to personalized and affordable care for hair loss, ED, weight loss, and more, visit Hims.com/Solomonster. That's Hims.com/Solomonster for your free online visit. Hims.com/Solomonster. Individual results may vary based on studies of topical and oral minoxidil and finasteride. Prescription required. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information. The first Dynamite coming out of All Out was in Pittsburgh on Wednesday, and there was no Britt Baker, which tells you all you need to know about her standing in the company and whether they intend to ever bring her back. They don't. Because if they did, that would have been the place to do it. So she is benched until her contract is up. Not the best follow-up to the pay-per-view. I don't understand how you don't put a live microphone in Eddie Kingston's hand and let him talk to the people after 16 months on the shelf. Like, Eddie, more than most in this company, has a very special connection to the fans. and he was gone for a very long time. He wasn't even on the show. They saved him for a tag team match on Collision instead. I thought that was a missed opportunity. But there were some solid matches on the show. They had a good angle at the very end with Chris Statlander, who defended her newly won women's world title in the main event against Mina Shirakawa. She rejected an invitation to join the Death Riders. After that, Darby Allin walked out with a flamethrower to chase away Jon Moxley and the Death Riders and issued the challenge to an I Quit match with Moxley at WrestleDream. The Statlander stuff was good, though. Brody King and Bandido, they retained their AEW tag team titles over the Gates of Agony, coming off their win with Ricochet over the Hurt Syndicate at All Out. They were due for a trios title match, but they claimed that Katsuyori Shibata was not medically cleared to wrestle, so they got a tag team title match instead. I don't know why it needed to be for the titles if they were just going to beat them, but the right team won anyway. So long as they do the match for the trios titles, I would put the belts on Ricochet and GOA. And if they don't, since they already lost to Brodito, I don't know where they go from here. Orange Cassidy is back. He teamed up with Mark Briscoe and Hologram against Okada, Takeshita, and Hechicero. I take it the plan may have been to have Briscoe challenge Okada soon for the unified title? Or it should be. If it isn't, it should be, right? I mean, he just picked up the biggest win of his AEW career over MJF at All Out. A former AEW world champion, mind you, the longest reigning AEW world champion of all time. If Briscoe is not next in line to challenge Hangman, then a match with Okada should be the goal. But I thought they really needed to make a bigger deal out of him beating MJF, and they really didn't. But it was Hologram who picked up the win here, because Hologram was supposed to be challenging Kyle Fletcher for the TNT Championship this week on the 6-year anniversary episode of Dynamite. It was to have been title versus streak, since Hologram is undefeated at 34-0. Take that, Undertaker. And they've also been teasing the arrival of Hologram's evil lucha twin, El Clone. So El Clone was probably going to cost Hologram his streak on Wednesday. But the match is now off after they opened Collision last night with Kyle Fletcher attacking Hologram backstage. This felt like their way of writing him off as quickly as possible. Tony Khan now says that Hologram suffered significant injuries and is likely out for the rest of 2025. This does not feel like an angle to me, so he must have gotten hurt, although I don't know how or where it would have happened. It would have, I guess, had to have been in the trios match on Wednesday, but I didn't notice anything out of the ordinary. So instead of title versus streak, it's now going to be Orange Cassidy challenging for the TNT Championship and likely losing his first singles match back. What that means for El Clone? Who knows? Maybe they'll debut him anyway. I would debut him anyway. Debut him anyway, let him run up his own 34-0 streak so that when Hologram comes back, they could do streak against streak. And all 235,000 fans watching on Collision will rejoice. That's what they did 2 weeks ago. College football is really kicking their ass right now. By the way, they announced randomly last night that Kenny Omega is back on Dynamite this week to team with Brody King and Bandido against Josh Alexander and the Young Bucks. The last time we saw Omega, he was stretchered out of the 2300 arena by Kyle Fletcher. But apparently Kenny Omega just wants to get back in the ring here. They want him back in the ring on this anniversary show. But that should be the WrestleDream match, Fletcher against Omega. And if they do it, Kyle Fletcher needs to beat Kenny Omega. He lost to Hangman already. Didn't win the world title. I don't think anybody expected him to. But he says he proved that he could hang by going 40 minutes with Hangman Page. That's great. What's the excuse if he loses to Kenny? You already proved that you can hang, right? That's not enough. You're the TNT champion. What good does it do him now if he goes in there and loses? That's a match he should be winning. Hangman Page defended the AEW World Championship on Wednesday in an open challenge against Lee Moriarty, the reigning Ring of Honor Pure Champion, since they were in Moriarty's hometown of Pittsburgh. I guess Mark Briscoe's great sin was being born in Delaware and not being born in Pittsburgh, or else maybe he would have gotten the match with Hangman. See, that would have made far more sense. Actually, I'll tell you what. Setting up a title match between Page and Briscoe for the anniversary show this week, that would have made the most sense. and then really drive home how much that match means to Mark Briscoe and what his brother would have thought. Like, really rally the fans behind this man for this major match, the biggest of his career, fighting for the world championship. And then if you want Hangman to go off with a member of the Death Riders at WrestleDream for the title, which is what it looks like they're doing, then you can have the Death Riders spoil the party at the end of the match. Or you could have the Callis family, you know, so Briscoe could go off and fight with them. Instead, they gave us Hangman against a low-level name that's never on Dynamite and who should not be wrestling for the world title in the second match on the show on Wednesday. Since Hangman was doing a run-in later, they had him come out to save the ops from the Death Riders. So they put his AEW world title match on second from the bottom. And then this Wednesday, we're getting Hangman and the Ops against Moxley, Claudio, and Daniel Garcia, which is far less appealing than a Hangman Briscoe title match would have been. It's just one of those booking pet peeves that I have. You know, we spent weeks watching Hangman tell MJF, you get no title match. You want to wrestle for the championship? You got to cash in that contract because you haven't earned it. You've got to prove to me that you can earn a shot on your own. Evidently, the champion gets to call his own shots. So Mark Briscoe beats MJF, but Hangman doesn't think Briscoe is deserving of a shot. I guess he hasn't earned it, but Lee Moriarty has, because he's from Pittsburgh. Okay. But the big announcement on the show that was promoted for days, Tony Khan's important announcement, was the addition of new women's tag team titles. Titles that were created over a year ago and have been sitting in a safe, collecting dust. He was waiting for the right time to unveil them. And look, the last thing this company needs are more belts. I saw Mina Shirakawa walking out for her match with Chris Statlander with a belt. And it took me a while to figure out what fucking belt she was wearing around her waist. She is the interim television champion in Ring of Honor, because the champion, Red Velvet's been out hurt since June. It's almost October. You would have to go all the way back to April to find the last time that TV title was even defended. Why does Ring of Honor need an interim champion for the women's TV title? Just strip her of the fucking belt. Why? Because she's been champion for over a year? You don't want to ruin that run? Who cares? Nobody cares. The title is not that important that it needs an interim version. But there was Mina with the interim title, and we've got ROH belts all over these shows again. So this is the last thing this company needs are more belts, but they have them now, and the best thing I could say about this is that they're in a much better position to actually have them than WWE, for example, because unlike WWE, AEW has more of an actual division. They've been pairing different women up now for months in preparation for this. They have the teams to make this work if he really puts the effort into it. You've got Toni Storm, who just lost her world championship. She was practically catatonic at the end of that match at All Out. I don't know what the direction is for her, but Toni and Mina, I could see them being a team. Mina, just before her match on Wednesday, Mina was talking about Toni Storm in the back. I haven't talked to her, but, you know, I'm here for her. I'm her best friend. I could see Toni and Mina becoming a team. Chris Statlander is the AEW Women's World Champion. It doesn't mean that she can't also go for the tag team titles. Her and Harley Cameron, or at some point her and Willow Nightingale, I'm sure they're going to end up being a team. You got Megan Bain and Penelope Ford. You've got Sky Blue and Julia Hart. You've got Anna Jay and Ty Mello. You've got Athena and Billy Starks. You could put them together as a team. That would be a way to keep Athena on AEW television. I mean, Tony Khan says that Athena's all banged up. That's the only reason we haven't seen her. Deonna Purrazzo and Taya Valkyrie. I mean, nobody would benefit more from this than Deonna Purrazzo and Taya Valkyrie. They can't buy themselves time. You know how they have those infomercials? They have those time buys? They can't buy themselves time on this show. So for someone like that, like Deonna and Taya, this could be a great thing. And then, of course, you got Mercedes over in the corner. She's licking her chops right now trying to find a partner for this. You know, she got that little shiver up her spine when Tony was making that announcement and unveiling these belts. Not only are the women getting tag team belts, but they're also getting the first ever blood and guts match for the women in AEW. After Jamie Hayter beat Julia Hart on Collision last night, she was attacked by Tekla and Sky Blue. Queen Aminata ran out to even the odds, and Hayter said she was sick of this. And there was only one way to settle all of this. Three words. Blood and guts. And if ever it felt like there was a time to do one with the women, this is it. Especially because there's no need to do one with the men this year. They did not give any other details about who would be involved or when the match is taking place, but my guess would be the homecoming show at Daly's Place. They're going back home for Title Tuesday on October 7th. And then they also have a homecoming episode of Collision the next night. So if they want to load up the show against the NXT TNA Invasion special on October 7th, then you do it on Dynamite. But honestly, this is really, a lot of the stories with these women in these feuds have been playing out on Collision, not so much on Dynamite. So I could see it happening either one of those two nights. But Daly's Place feels like the right place for this. It's the place where they did the first ever Blood and Guts match. So what are we thinking here? We got Jamie Hayter, Queen Aminata, maybe throw Chris Statlander in there, Willow, and what, maybe Toni Storm? That's five. Against Tekla, Julia Hart, Sky Blue. You could have Marina Shafir in there if Willow is on the other side, since they've been beefing lately. But then who's the fifth member? Mercedes is the only other one I could think of. I mean, she really doesn't have anything to do with any of this, though. Unless you do Toni Storm, Mina Shirakawa, Chris Statlander, Jamie Hayter, and Queen Aminata. And they take on the Triangle of Madness, Megan Bain, and Penelope Ford. Then you have five. Jurassic Express, they were not on the show this week. They just reunited it all out. They were not on the show at all on Wednesday. They had a brief video package. They're saving them for the anniversary show this Wednesday. And Adam Copeland is gone for a while. He's going to be filming for the third season of Percy Jackson and the Olympians for Disney Plus. So no, he is not wrestling John Cena in his final match. I don't know where this got started. Probably just people assuming, oh, the timing of it. And then they let their imaginations run wild. But this became a thing on social media this week where maybe Adam Copeland is going back to WWE to wrestle John Cena in his final match on Saturday night's main event. In your dreams. It's not happening. Do not set yourself up for disappointment. If that is the match that you are looking forward to, you are not getting it. He is not going back to WWE. And frankly, even if his contract was up next month, and I think maybe this is where it started, people started putting pieces together. Oh, his contract is up in October. In fact, I think his contract is up in October of next year. But even if you assumed his contract was up next month, you don't think Tony Khan is well aware of all the chatter about him going back and doing this retirement match with John Cena? He broke his leg. He was out for like 8 months. Like, Tony would have so much injury time that he could tack onto this guy's contract. Like, it just, there's no possible scenario in which this happens. But I will say it was very entertaining looking at people trying to explain how, well, it's possible. There's a chance. No, there isn't. Some other news and notes. All movie related. Per Deadline.com, Drew McIntyre has been cast for a role in the upcoming Highlander reboot. This just seems so perfect for him. This is set to star Henry Cavill as Connor McLeod. McIntyre will star opposite Cavill as his older brother Angus. Dave Bautista has been cast as Kurgan, the villain of the film. Russell Crowe, Karen Gillan, and Jimin Hansu have also been cast in the movie. The project was in pre-production earlier this month before everything was halted when Cavill was injured during training. Production is expected to begin in early 2026. The original Highlander film was released in 1986, followed by several spin-offs and a weekly series following the adventures of Connor McLeod, one of many immortals at war with each other until there is only one left. Yes, you know, I never watched the Highlander series on a regular basis. I would see episodes here and there. I think it probably started in like 1992 or something. But I still remember the theme song. I still remember the theme song and the whole premise that the only way you could kill him was to chop his head off. But that song is still stuck in my head. And 2 days after I answered a question on the podcast about wrestlers that would have made great movie characters, we got this exclusive from Deadline.com on Tuesday. Artists for Artists, the production company of Kenan Thompson, and Johnny Ryan Jr. is developing a feature biopic on iconic wrestler Macho Man Randy Savage. We can tell you first. Thompson and Ryan Jr. come to the project titled Macho as lifelong fans of Savage. Thompson having worked with Savage on a Nickelodeon promo all the way back in 1999. The project stems from a completed script by Savage's brother, Lanny Poffo, who died in February of 2023, and Eric Shapiro. In a statement to Deadline, AFA's Ryan Jr. said Macho Man Randy Savage was the greatest showman of all time and the OG bad boy of entertainment. His outfits were as electric as his personality, and he's so much more than an artist, he's an icon. Lanny and Eric did a great job capturing this story in the crazy 80s wrestling era that turned wrestling figures into lifelong pop culture icons. Ryan Jr.'s partner, Kenan Thompson, told us, "Beyond excited for this one, Macho Man is hands down one of the greatest of all time and can't wait to bring his story to the screen." And you got one of the wrestlers that I said last week who would have made a great movie character was Macho Man Randy Savage. And now we hear they're making a movie about Macho Man Randy Savage. What else can I manifest into reality? All right, let's get to your mailbag questions. You can email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. We got Damon in Jacksonville. "I agree with you that it seems we are heading to war games with Cena and Brock on opposing teams. I also agree that Brock will likely be Cena's last opponent. In telling this story, how likely is it that Brock pins Cena in war games? It furthers the story of his dominance over Cena and thus prompts Cena to challenge Brock one final time in his last match." Well, you could tell that this email came in prior to the reports that came out this week. And if the reports are to be believed, we are not getting Brock Lesnar as John Cena's final opponent, which is just fine by me. But again, it makes what we saw at WrestlePalooza look even dumber. If they do end up in war games together and the plan, let's say, was for Brock to be his final opponent, then yes, Brock beating Cena again in war games would make sense. You know, with Cena demanding one last showdown with Brock, you know, where it's do or die, last chance. But it doesn't look like that's going to be happening. Carlos from Gaithersburg. "What are the chances that Cena's final opponent is The Rock? It's a big name main event match, and there is a story there considering Cena was Rock's enforcer for his failed exorcism of Cody Rhodes." I have no interest in seeing it, and I don't think there's a very good chance of that happening. I don't know what Rock is, his schedule is. I know he lost a bunch of weight to play the Chicken Man in some new movie. I don't know when that's filming. I don't know when that's going to be done filming, but it doesn't matter. I mean, the match is not that long away, right? That December 13th date, it's really not that far off. And if Rock just lost all that weight, and you saw the way he actually looks healthy now. He looks like a normal person now. But even if he was to film this role and then have some time to try to train, like, I don't see it. You're not going to get the final boss Rock in time for that match. He doesn't look like the final boss. So I don't think it's happening anyway. But I think just physically, I don't know that he can get himself in the shape he would want to be in to be in that match. So the answer is no. David from Sacramento, I wanted to run this idea by you. How would you feel if AJ Lee challenges Becky Lynch for the Intercontinental Championship but is screwed over by Nikki Bella to subway into that feud for a brief time, the story being that Nikki has been outshined and overlooked upon AJ's return? Would this be a good story to distract AJ and then she could come back to Becky sometime next year? If the idea is to wait to have Becky, you know, lose to AJ, you know, for the title of WrestleMania, let's say, then sure. I mean, you can have her go off and do any number of things with different people. I mean, I personally, if you're asking me, I have no interest in seeing AJ Lee against Nikki Bella. But if they wanted to go heel with Nikki, that would be a natural explanation for it. You know, you also have to have her bring up the fact then that she passed AJ's record as the longest reigning Divas champion of all time. There's that little bit of history there to play off of. But I mean, I didn't want to see AJ and Nikki Bella back then. Why would I want to see it now? Chris from North Jersey. Do you think Triple H getting the nod this year and Stephanie getting in next year to the Hall of Fame is a sign that they are A, firing Triple H soon, B, selling the company soon, C, both A and B, D, lack of headliners, or E, none of the above? I mean, they are running low on headliners. You know, they could put Cena in as early as next year if he's available. Right? Once he's retired, it's just a matter of picking the right year for John Cena to go into the Hall of Fame. Rock also still has to go in. Batista still has to go in. If Jericho comes back, he'll be in. Big Show, eventually, he's got to go in too, but he's still with AEW. But it's a combination of wanting a big name in there and not having that many left to choose from. You know, or at least the ones that are available. And also, he's putting his wife in the Hall of Fame. I mean, I'm not saying that she doesn't belong in there. She would have gotten in there eventually, as will Vince and as will Shane. But it's his wife. You know, he wanted to put his wife in the Hall of Fame. That's just what it comes down to. It's exactly what it looks like. You know, because in his mind, she's this iconic figure when it comes to women in wrestling, and she more than deserves it, but it's his fucking wife. So, of course, he's going to want to put her in. They're not selling the company, and he's not getting fired anytime soon. So it's not that. Green from Morocco. Rank these legendary referees. Earl Hebner, Mike Chioda, Tim White, and Charles Robinson. Those are four of the greats right there that you just named. Tommy Young is another one. I got to throw him in there. Iconic NWA referee. And probably Red Shoes in Japan. Red Shoes Uno. But of those four, I am partial to Earl Hebner at number one because he reffed all the big matches of my wrestling youth. And he took some of the biggest bumps, too. Now, I see where he also loved the camera, and he would put himself in situations where he should have been in the background. I can see why some people really don't like him. There are some people that don't like the cadence of his counts as well. They thought that the way he would count near falls gave away that it wasn't going to be a three count. I honestly never really noticed that with him. There are certain referees who had a very weird cadence. Nick Patrick in WCW was one of those people. I never liked the way that he counted. It was just very strange to me. So I just never thought much of him as a referee. But again, so with Earl Hebner, you'll get a mixed opinion. But for me, he's got to be number one. And then I would go Charles Robinson, and then Chioda, and then Tim White. Gibran from Germany. This weekend, Bret Hart was in Germany for an event, and I finally got a chance to meet him in person. He was super nice and friendly, which gave me a chance to put up a quick question. One of my all-time favorite matches is the Survivor Series 1995 match between Bret and Diesel. Apart from the excellent match they had together, what made this match even more special for me as a kid was the table spot. I asked Bret who came up with that, and he confirmed that it was his idea, and also admitted that the gimmick table was a really hard one to go through. As a 10-year-old at the time, I had never seen a wrestler go through a table before. And I'm quite sure this was a very unique spot in mainstream pro wrestling at the time. Table break itself was picture perfect, and you can see from the crowd reaction how special that moment was. Maybe I'm a bit biased since Bret is my favorite wrestler of all time, but I truly feel this is such an underrated moment in WWE history and a moment which made table spots a staple of modern pro wrestling. I don't think Bret gets credit for introducing the table. He puts introducing in quotes, the table spot to mainstream audiences. What do you think? So first off, very cool photos he shared with me. So I thank you for sharing that. I have met Bret in person. I met him at Caroline's on Broadway here in New York for a signing many years ago. It was him and Ric Flair. I got my Spotlight magazine, my WWF Spotlight magazine signed from 1994 with Bret on the cover. I have it framed. Never got a photo with him, though. That's still on my list of things to do. I almost had the chance to host a Q&A with him this summer, but it fell through. That would have been very cool. But as far as introducing the table spot to mainstream audiences, I mean, there have been table spots in wrestling going back to at least the 70s in some of the territories, I'm sure. Mainstream, Bret was not the first. I mean, mainstream, the earliest one that I personally remember was from the Hulk Hogan-Harley race match on Saturday night's main event. So that would have been in 88, I believe. That was the spot where Harley came off the apron very slowly. But he came off the apron. He literally just fell off the apron. More so than he didn't jump off so much as he fell off. Hogan moved, and Harley landed belly first through the table. and he injured himself very badly. The spot itself, if you watch it, it doesn't look bad. It's just that internally he really fucked himself up and he needed surgery. And that was a Hulk Hogan match on NBC in the middle of the Hogan era. Like, I would say it doesn't get more mainstream than that back then. And then in 89, the following year, there was a famous angle where Terry Funk gave Ric Flair a pile driver on top of a table. I don't remember if that was a Clash of the Champions or if it was Wrestle War, but it was, you know, it was an NWA event. So no, Brett was not the first to do it, but you could say he was the first to popularize it in the WWF, since it's the one most people probably remember. Unless you were an ECW fan, then you saw shit like that all the time. Alberto from Laredo, Texas. I was wondering if you could tell us about the match between Rhino and Tajiri. It was a house show match that Vince McMahon found so boring, he came out in the middle of it and stopped it. Have there been other stories similar to this? There was a house show here at the Nassau Coliseum. Rhino and Tajiri, they had a match. There was an agent. I don't know who the agent was. I don't think Rhino ever said who it was. But according to him, the agent told them before the match, if the fans chant boring at you, just grab a hold and sit on it. And sure enough, the fans started chanting boring because Nassau is a tough building, notoriously. It always has been. Which is probably why the agent said that. I mean, I was at a Raw show in 2001. Had to be 2001 because Paul Heyman was on commentary. During one of the commercial breaks, Heyman, and I'm sure they had him do this, but Heyman put his headset down. He stood up. He stood on the stairs outside, the ring steps, and he took the house mic and he called us the worst crowd in the history of wrestling. That's the Nassau Coliseum. And then he went back to commentary and the show continued after insulting the audience. So anyway, they start chanting boring and Vince marches to the ring and he tells them to get out. The match is over. Rhino thought he was joking. And then the referee's like, I think he's serious. So he kicked these two men out of the ring in the middle of their match, embarrassed them in front of thousands of people so he could get an early start to the bikini contest that they were doing with Sable and Tori Wilson and whoever else was out there. I think Vince was the MC for it. So then later on, when Rhino confronts Vince about it, he said that Vince told him the fans were chanting boring at the two of you. And he told Vince, he said, one of your agents told us that if they chant boring to just grab a hold. And Vince tells him, well, obviously that agent wasn't a top guy. Top guys save their money so they don't have to become agents. But he says Vince must have felt bad about doing that because the check that he got, you know, however many weeks later, for the match that night was a lot bigger than it usually was. He got a good payoff for that match. So, I mean, I can't think of any other stories of Vince storming out to the ring like that other than the Royal Rumble where Cena and Batista fell out of the ring at the same time and then Vince was all pissed off and he marched down to the ring and he tore his quad. I mean, there have been stories about him not liking matches. I mean, there was an In Your House in Winnipeg with a fucking terrible main event between Diesel and the British Bulldog that was so bad when the show went off the air, Vince threw his headset down in disgust. I remember that. But I mean, that's the closest thing I could think of. I can't think of anything else. Kennedy from Orlando, Florida. What are your top five wrestlers who were the biggest waste of potential? People that completely ruined their own careers. All right. So that's an important distinction to make because you have people whose careers were ruined by others and by booking. But then you have people who were basically their own worst enemy and couldn't get out of their own way. This is probably closer to a top 10 than it is a top 5. I don't know how I would rank them. I jotted down a bunch of names here. I'm not ranking them necessarily. I will say this, though. Teddy Hart has to be at the top of any list. Teddy Hart is somebody who had a world of potential and should have been much, much bigger than he was. And through no one's fault but his own, he was not. When I think of wasted potential, Teddy Hart is at the top of the list. Another guy, and you may or may not hear this name mentioned, but another guy is Buddy Landell. Nature Boy Buddy Landell. How many Nature Boys have there been? We had Buddy Rogers, right? We had Ric Flair. We had Buddy Landell. I'm sure there were others. What is a Nature Boy exactly? Still haven't answered that question. Buddy Landell, this is a guy who should have had a Hall of Fame career. Dusty Rhodes was going to book him against Flair to win the NWA title, right? The Battle of the Nature Boys, because their matches were doing big business. And the problem is the booze and the drugs, they took over. I think he missed a TV taping that he was booked for and Dusty fired him. I know years later, Jim Cornette, because he's talked about this, he's talked about the Moon River incident years later in Smoky Mountain, and he liked Buddy. But, you know, there was a good buddy and there was a bad buddy. And in that one, he was booked in an I Quit match with someone that he didn't like. And so he's trapped in a submission hold. And when the referee holds the microphone to his mouth and asks him, "Do you give up?" he starts singing Moon River, which sounds funny, but Cornette didn't find it very funny and he fired him. But I remember they brought him into the WWF and like the end of 95. I think they brought him in for like a week. He did a bunch of matches, right? He wrestled Ahmed Johnson on an In Your House pay-per-view. I remember that. I want to say it was the night that Jeff Jarrett came back to the company, because Jarrett had lost the Intercontinental title to Shawn Michaels in July at In Your House. And then him and Road Dogg, they literally left the building. Like, they stormed out. Road Dogg, I think, did it more just in solidarity with him. But Jarrett just was not happy with the booking, and he was gone. He was gone for a few months. But he came back at the end of the year, and I think he was there that night, but instead of him wrestling, if I'm remembering this correctly, he brought out Buddy Landell, who of course got killed by Ahmed Johnson. But then he worked a bunch of matches that week for like some of the tapings. He wrestled Bret Hart for the WWF title. So that was the end of 95, and obviously they didn't call him back after that week. I think the last match he ever worked for them was against Triple H. It was on like a Shotgun Saturday Night taping, and it was during the Attitude Era. This was years later. After that, I can't remember a fucking thing that he did. But, you know, as they say, he fumbled. This wasn't Vince McMahon's fault. This wasn't any other person's fault but his own. Buddy fumbled. He fumbled what should have been a Hall of Fame career because he was unreliable and out of control. Matt Bourne is another one. Just watch the Dark Side of the Ring episode they did on him. Matt Bourne was immensely talented. He was also, from the sounds of it, a piece of shit. But he was immensely talented. I mean, Evil Doink. Come on, man. That should have been a bigger run than it was. So there was more potential for him to be a bigger star than he was. Two names I talked about last week. Somebody asked me in the mailbag. Low Key and Austin Aries. Just couldn't seem to get out of their own way. Matt Riddle. We've seen Matt Riddle in the news. Matt Riddle should have been a world heavyweight champion in WWE. The reason he isn't has nothing to do with WWE. Velveteen Dream. Talk about wasted potential. He would have been a world champion as well on the main roster. Tessa Blanchard. Tessa Blanchard should have already headlined a WrestleMania with Charlotte Flair. She should already be in WWE. She may eventually get there yet, but her career stalled out, not because of anybody but herself. So those are some of the names that I would have on that list. I'm sure we could add others. But keep emailing me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. I do read everything you send me, even if I can't get to it all, but I will try to. Follow me on X @Solemonster. That is where I am most active. And of course, on the YouTube channel, I'll be live this week for the Raw post show on Monday night. We have Tuesday Night Titans back in its normal slot this week over on JD's channel. We were bumped to Thursday for this week, but we're back on Tuesday this week. Wednesday night, the Dynamite 6-year anniversary show. I'll be live when that's over, and then SmackDown coming up on Friday. Of course, next Sunday, back with you for episode 932 of The Sound Off. Until then, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great week. When I see you back here next time, it's going to be October. My favorite month. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solemonster sounds off.
They closed the show with the contract signing with Drew McIntyre and Cody Rhodes. And Drew said no. Cody doesn't even think about himself anymore. He thinks about what's best for the company. He's the corporate champion. So he says they, being the fans, are going to turn on you because you're the flavor of the month. And then Cody is going to say Drew was right. Cody said if Drew is wrong, his legacy then becomes the man who lost to Cody on their debut ESPN PLE. Let's talk about a mouthful here. He definitely went into corporate Cody mode here. You lose. lose to me, you're going to be the guy who lost to me on the ESPN PLE debut for the undisputed WWE Championship presented by Netflix. Shut the fuck up, dude. I want Drew to win the title. Fuck it. Put the title on Drew. Shake this shit up and just put the title on Drew. I think I've turned on Cody here in this promo. I think Drew was right. He's way too corporate for my liking.
The Solomonster sounds off.
Since 2007.
Bringing you the good,
the bad,
and the ugly. Check out the weekly live streams, bonus content for subscribers, and follow The Solomonster on Facebook, Instagram, and X. The Solomonster.
I love you so long.